Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So we are coming towards the end of Book 7, the Book of Yoga. We've come to the last canto, Canto, which is called Cosmic Spirit and the Cosmic Consciousness. And we've reached page 553. I think we stopped at line 78. Oh, we've gone further. Okay. All right, yes. Near the bottom of the page, a dual power. We'll go this way, Margaret. Will you start, please?
A dual power at beings' occult poles still acted, nameless and invisible. Her divine emptiness was their instrument. In conscience nature dealt with the world it had made, and using still the body's instruments, slipped through the conscious void she had become. The superconscient mystery through that void missioned its word to touch the thoughts of men.
Let's pause there. We remind ourselves that in the previous canto, we had seen Savitri's being completely silenced, widened, impersonalized, so that there was no more sense of individual self, except she had this experience of being just like a shadow, a violet vestige, like a vanishing trace, as if everything that has been herself is faded away. And last week we read how she, in that state of silence, she is waiting what will be the decree of the Supreme Reality. Will she vanish? Will she return and become something? That will not depend on her choice. This will depend on the choice of the Supreme Reality. And then we started this canto where we're shown how there she is, living still in the hermitage, in the forest. And although she's in this very, very different state, nobody notices anything. And she herself has the feeling that it's almost inevitable that she will cease to exist altogether. And yet, there was something else, the sense of this higher reality, this high surpassing secrecy. And when she's sitting alone, well, sitting with Satyavan, her moveless mind with his that searched and strove in the hush of the profound and intimate night, she turns her attention towards the face of a veiled, voiceless truth that she senses hid in the dumb recesses of the heart, or waiting beyond the last peak climbed by thought. That something watches, even prompts our quest for it, and yet it seems to hide itself. It doesn't, as if it doesn't want to be found. But she experiences that out of that vast silence, a reply does come, some kind of message, the message of the bodiless light. And then we read that when she was sitting with the sages of the woods, listening to them sharing their intuitions, their insights, in question and in answer, broke from her. It's not that she speaks, but something speaks through her. high, strange revealings, impossible to men. Something or someone, secret and remote, took hold of her body for its mystic use, and her mouth was seized to channel ineffable truths. So now what Margaret read is a kind of explanation of what is happening with Savitri.
I have a question.
Yes.
Line 75.
Yes.
Could you explain again, irresponsible sovereignty?
That this is of this something unknown.
Yes.
Yes, it sent down the messages of a bodiless light. And it has a power. It is a mastery, a sovereignty. And that sovereignty is not responsible to anybody or anything except itself. It's irresponsible mastery. It seized hold on the power of speech to give those flamings the light that it is bringing, to give expression to them. It may beat the heart of wisdom in a word and spoke immortal things through these mortal lips of human Savitri. And I explained last week that this was an experience which Sri Aurobindo had, after his first major spiritual experience. Yes?
The word irresponsible, perhaps the reason that Lucretia asked it there,
yes,
is that under normal circumstances, when somebody who does bad things without any punishments or anything doesn't care, it's a negative word. And
yes, normally the word irresponsible is a negative word, but we've seen many, many times that Sri Aurobindo uses these negative words in a paradoxical way, and that is to force us to think about it a little bit, not just to take the word at its face value. What might it mean? So the interpretation that I give is that sovereignty, that great mastery of the supreme reality, is not answerable to anybody except itself. It can act. To us it might seem irresponsible. There's that poor Savitri, and without her knowing or willing, it just seizes hold on her and speaks out. But we should be grateful when that sovereignty seizes hold on us and uses us, however irresponsible it may seem. There's one of Sri Aurobindo's aphorisms where he says that words come out of the mouth at which reason trembles. How could I say something like that?
Also, when Sri Aurobindo came out of jail, ne? And then he has said he would say other words, but the Supreme Divine gave the words in his mouth.
Spoken, yes. So that something is taking hold of her body for his mystic use, and her mouth was seized to channel ineffable truths. So this is happening without the participation of her individual being. These thoughts were formed not in her listening brain. Her vacant heart was like a stringless harp. Impassive, the body claimed not its own voice, but let the luminous greatness through it pass. So then Sri Aurobindo takes it further. He says that what is happening is that a dual power at the hidden poles, at the hidden extremes of existence, are still acting, even in this silent state that Savitri is in. They are still acted, nameless and invisible. And her divine emptiness was their instrument, because she's so empty and silent. There's two powers, or a dual power. He says there, her divine emptiness was their instrument. And now he's going to tell us what are these two powers from the extremes of existence. One is inconscient nature, just earth nature, apparently without consciousness, going on doing what it always does. Inconscient nature dealt with the world it had made. And using still the body's instruments, slipped through this conscious void she had become. That's, we can say, from below, from the inconscient nature, the habitual movements that pass through her silent consciousness and move the lips, the body, to do whatever needs to be done. That's why nobody noticed any change, any difference. All her actions were the same. She seemed to be unchanged. But at the same time, the superconscient mystery, that high reality which she is sensing, also through that void, that emptiness, missioned its word to touch the thoughts of men. So she speaks, and her words have an effect. And it says that the sages marveled at her, because she seemed to know what they had only glimpsed at times, sometimes, from far away. Shall we go on from there, Prasad? You would be next. Last line of page 553.
As yet, this very impersonal speech was rare. But now, the unmoving wild spiritual space in which her mind survived tranquil and vague, admitted a traveler from the cosmic breadths, a thought came through wrapped as an outer voice. It called not for the witness of the mind, it spoke not to the hushed receiving heart. It came direct to the pure perception seat, and only center now of consciousness. If center could be there, all seeing only space, no more shut in my body's walls and gates, no more shut in my body's wall and gates, a being, a circle without circumference, already now surpassed all cosmic bounds, and more spread into infinity.
Thank you. So that impersonal speech, when the reality speaks through her, he says, as yet, this great impersonal speech was rare. It didn't happen often. But now, this unmoving, wide, spiritual space in which her mind survived, tranquil and bare, it admitted, it accepted a traveler from the cosmic breadths, from the wide spaces of the universe. It allows something to enter in. Thought came through, and it's covered, it's draped, covered as an outer voice. She hears something. Sri Aurobindo doesn't tell us the words that she hears, but that thought came expressed as a voice. And this voice doesn't address itself to the mind, although her mind is still there, empty and bare. No? It doesn't speak to the heart, even though her silent heart is ready to receive something. No? It came direct to the seat of the pure perception. If we go back
546.
Page 546. Thank you, Patricia. Yes. Near the top, line 501, 502. A pure perception was the only power that is still supporting her action and her power of seeing. And if that was withdrawn, then she would not be aware of any her, the whole universe would cease to exist. So that is the central part of her awareness, this power of pure, not dependent on the senses, not dependent on interpretation by the mind, a direct, pure perception. So this traveler speaks to that center. And Sri Aurobindo then says that that seed of the pure perception was now the only center of Savitri's consciousness. And then he says, if there can be a center when everything is only space, her being is no longer shut in by the walls and the gates of the body. I read a long time ago, and now I can't really remember exactly what I read, but I think the body is supposed to have 19 gates by which our consciousness communicates with the world around. So, but her being is no longer limited by the walls and the gates of the body. Her being has become a circle, but it has no limit. A circumference is the limit of the circle. And it's already far wider than the universe. It surpassed all cosmic bounds. And it's spreading more and more and more into infinity. At the beginning of Canto 6, when she had that terrible experience of an overwhelming darkness, shattering experience that left her inner world laid waste, then she was told by the guiding voice from above that in order to fulfill her mission, she's going to have to expand her consciousness so that it is that the whole universe is only happening in a tiny corner of it somewhere, and if it would all dissolve, it wouldn't matter at all. So now we see that she's achieving that vastness through this discipline that she's passed through, these experiences that we've read about the last weeks.
Would you say that individuality is retained?
It's only that trace. There is a center. No? It says that seed of pure perception is a center, but there's no limiting boundary to that.
Where it's centered?
In within Savitri, somewhere deep within. He doesn't say exactly where it is. This seat of the pure perception, which is the only faculty of awareness that she still has.
She says that it is not in the mind, not
of awareness. This is somewhere, no, if that empty space could be said as a center, then that is center.
That pure, the seat of the pure perception is the only center that she now has of consciousness. And then he says, if we can call it a center, if there could be a center where everything seems to be only unlimited space. We came across this once before, do you remember Don? Where we, I think it's in Aswapati's yoga, where Sri Aurobindo spoke of an experience like this, that Aswapati's awareness was like a center of infinity. And you said, how can there be a center to infinity? So then I pointed out it didn't say the center, it said a center. So there can be an infinite number of centers of infinity.
There is no circumference.
There's no circumference. Yes.
So
it says without circumference.
Center
without it's limited. Yeah. It's
so
limitless. Sorry, Rafaela, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, is this what Sri Aurobindo at another place calls central being?
I can't answer that question.
In the sense of approximately Jivatman.
I don't want to put any label on it. Let's stick to his, whatever we can grasp of his discussion, description, sorry. Yes, Don.
In regard to individuality, what is being said here, as I understand it, is that there is no longer in her individuality there. There is perception. And
there's a state of impersonal perception.
Impersonal perception. The personal is gone.
But he told us that what once had been herself, now I'm reading at the bottom of page 548. What once had been herself had disappeared. There was no frame of things, no figure of soul.
No
circumference.
Unutterably effaced. No one and null, a vanishing vestige, like a violet trace, a record merely of a self now past. She was a point in the unknowable. That's what he says. And that point must be the point where this, the seat of this pure perception, which is unlimited and spreading wider and wider. Yes, Doctor.
I can't take it away from you, but the sense of consciousness, I think it's a sense of perception, it's a way of identification, knowledge through identification. It identifies itself directly without having the perception of other senses. It is there.
It's pure perception.
Princess touch, hearing, all that is left, you know. The way she knows the things that don't like that is because she straight away directly identifies herself with whatever comes as truth to her.
But he describes it. He describes it at this first stage, which is not the last stage. He describes it as a sense of the illusoriness of all that. All that has no reality, no importance, it's something cinematic, you know.
Yes.
She's aware, it's coming to the pure perception seat, because that pure perception is there, she is aware of the universe, but there, at this time there's no sense of identification that comes next. Let's read on. Yeah? Who is next? Jan.
Where is it exactly?
Line 116 on page 554.
This being was its own unbounded world, a world without form or feature or circumstance. It had no ground, no wall, no roof of thought, yet saw itself and looked on all around. In a silence motionless and illimitable, there was no person there, no centered mind, no seat of feeling on which beat events or objects wrought and shaped reactions stress. There was no motion in this inner world. All was still and even infinity. In her, the unseen, the unknown waited his hour.
Oh,
but now she sat.
We'll pause there. All was a still and even infinity. world without form or feature or circumstance. Perhaps we could say that this is a state of identification with the unknowable. And he says unseen, the unknown. But into that has come this thought, draped as an outer voice. And that thought has an effect. That's what comes in the next section.
But what is it? His owl. Who is his owl?
The unseen, the unknown. This reality which she is aware of, but which is completely ungraspable, unknowable.
This being was its own unbounded world?
That is Savitri's being.
Her perception.
Her being.
Sorry. Her perception.
Yeah.
That includes like whatever she sees around her, the people walking, is that perception there?
It was doing that. She was responding and going on with life without any identification with it. But here it almost sounds as if her consciousness is aware only of a world without form or feature or circumstance.
So that kind of disappeared and she's...
Yes, of course she's in a state of concentration or trance in the night. It seems to be. Now we'll read about the voice. Aran, will you read? Franz.
But now she said, by sleeping, Satyavans. The day is in, and the enormous night surrounded her with the unknowable. The voice began to speak from her own heart. That was not hers, that mastered thought and sense. As it spoke, all changed within her and without. All was, all lived, she felt all being one. The world of unreality ceased to be. There was no more a universe built by mind. Convicted as a structure or a sign. The spirit, the being soul, created things and cast itself into unnumbered forms and was what it saw and made, all now became an evidence of one stupendous truth, truths in which negation had no place, the being and the living consciousness. Dark and absolute reality. There the unreal could not find a place. The sense of unreality was slain. There all was conscious, made of infinite, and all had the substance of eternity.
Thank you. I think we should pause. Thank you. So this is a completely opposite experience. She's been in that state of being nothing and null, no one and none. But whatever it is that voice says to her, it changes, gives her an experience which is completely different. Now there's no more unreality possible even. Everything is real. Because there's a spirit, there's a being. There was that vast, silent impersonality. But now, a spirit, a being, is watching all these created things and pours itself into all these different forms and becomes what it saw and made. So everything in the universe now becomes an evidence, a proof of one stupendous truth. a truth in which negation had no place. The end of the previous canto spoke about the lonely absolute which negated everything, which effaced the ignorant world from its solitude and drowned the soul in its everlasting peace. That's a state which has been the goal of so many spiritual seekers. And when they've reached that state, they have found it so convincing, this experience we read at the beginning of the canto, where she's absolutely silent within, but she's still, the body goes on still working, this dual power does what it has to do. And so that's the state, I think, of the Jivan Mukta, the living, liberated being. So it's something immensely powerful and valuable, but it's not the absolutely ultimate experience.
Can we say it's not the only experience? I mean,
yes.
I don't know if you could say that somehow it's not real or something. Or
no, it is such a powerful reality that it's given rise to millennia of spiritual seeking and spiritual knowledge and realization in India, so we can't say it's not real. This second thing shows that there's no such thing as unreality. I was just looking up today, I was thinking of Sonam, I was looking up, I remembered some passages where Sri Aurobindo speaks about Advaita. And he says there's this illusory Advaita, which tells us that all is the Supreme One and everything else is unreal. But to him, that is not the full Advaita. The full Advaita says, the real Advaita, he calls it, says, all this is real because all this is made of that One. If the One is gold, then everything that it has formed out of itself is also gold, is also real. So perhaps we cannot have this the full experience without having passed through that emptiness, that complete emptying and loss of ego, dissolving. But he tells us several times in the poem, that's not everything. Well, why has God made this world all, after all? If all you have to do is dissolve and separate yourself from it. He had a purpose. And what are you doing now for that purpose? What have you done? So I think what he shows us in the second half of this canto is the other realization.
Shadavandaya, when questioned about all had the substance of eternity.
Yes.
Is also one substance?
Yes.
Okay.
It's difficult for us to connect these two words, substance and eternity.
Yeah.
But she becomes aware of a substance that expresses eternity.
Okay.
That is not our matter, which, or maybe is our matter, perhaps that's what it means. That all this is a substance, a temporary substance and form of eternity. Lydia?
Maybe just a single body, a unique body, which contains all.
It's
and
that.
It's just one center. It is a world body, the world universe.
But it's unlimited, this
unlimited.
Center.
It's
and it pours itself
infinite.
Into all the forms of all created things. They wouldn't exist, they couldn't live, if it were not for that oneness within themselves.
But this oneness is also the center? No, is there something outside the center?
No, I don't think so.
Is it in the center? It's connected to the center. There
is the same. Everything is one and one is all.
Maybe you could. Yes.
It's very strange.
Just a moment, somebody was speaking.
Maybe the Trinitarian concept could give more insight into the origin that pulls itself out into everything, is everything, and relates to itself.
Yes, we can think of it. It's helpful. Thank you. Shobindo tells us that the divine oneness can be experienced in three ways. One is as unlimited, unknowable, infinite, eternal. And another is the multiplicity of individualities. And these are held together by the universal oneness.
Also because it's a spirit, actually. It's a spirit that coming out of the
out of the essence, the reality.
Yeah, out of the relationship between between forms and form, the inimitable and the limitation, the spirit comes out of it and takes form.
And if we think that the origin of the manifestation is conscious force, then there's an infinite number of conscious relationships that can take place within this oneness. Let's go back to the text.
I have a question, but the Najanga was said I lost the center. Experience when Mother lost the center.
So perhaps that is this experience of nothing and no one and now. And definitely both she and Shobindo had this experience of loss of the physical ego. So that there could be identification with all the forms.
Okay. Thank you.
So who will read next? Evelyn.
Yet this was the same
indecipherable.
Indecipherable. It seemed to pass from the universe like a dream, vanishing forever into an original world. But this was no more some very ubiquitous point on the cycle of vastness in unreal world. It was the same, but now no more seemed far to the living task of her recovered soul. It was herself, it was the self of all, it was the reality of existing things. It was the consciousness of all that lived and felt and so. It was timelessness and time. It was the bliss of formlessness and form. It was all love and the one beloved's arm. It was sight and thought in one all-seeing mind. It was joy of being on the peaks of God.
Thank you. So this is a progressive experience, step by step. Or at least it's described step by step. So this step which we read about, this spirit and this being casting itself into unnumbered forms, this truth in which negation had no place, all was conscious, made of the infinite. Everything had a substance of eternity. But it was the same indecipherable. If something is indecipherable, you can't read it. You can't know what it says. It's unknowable, ununderstandable. She sees that this new experience is about the same one, the same reality that she was experiencing before. But now that awareness or perception of it has changed, it still seems to be separate from the universe. It casts from it universe like a dream, It's going further and further into this original emptiness. But it's no longer something vague, a vague, ubiquitous point. Ubiquitous means present everywhere.
How can a point be ubiquitous?
How can a point be ubiquitous? But if each individualization, each form, is a point, is a center of the infinite, then that point can be everywhere. It's not limited by time and space. And it's not a cipher, not just a zero, a vastness in unreal nothingness. It was the same, but now no more seemed far to the living clasp of her recovered soul. She's got back the sense of her own individual divinity, her own individual existence. Her soul is back somehow. And this reality is herself. It was the self of all. It was the reality of all existing things. It was the consciousness of everything that lived and felt and saw. It was timelessness and time. It was bliss of formlessness and form. It was sight and thought in one all-seeing mind. It was joy of being on the peaks of God.
That's the line, it was all love and the one beloved arms.
Oh, I missed the line. Yes, sorry, beautiful line.
Yeah.
Again, please.
And what is the one beloved's arms then?
This reality. It was all and the one beloved's arms. So the oneness of the lover and the love and the beloved. All. So it seems to reconcile all the things that we perceive as oppositions and contradictions. It brings them all together in its one reality. But you had something to
yes.
ask.
The word cipher can mean zero, of course.
Mm.
But also another thing which I think is quite appropriate, in fact, is said, here it is the sense of a disguised mode of communication as in a code or a cryptograph.
That's another thing that a cipher can mean, a code. Yes. So both those meanings are there in the word.
But all of the individual things that we see are part of that code and go on infinitely.
I want to be present here more, so, but there's something that I must air out, and that is, how can I include my consciousness when I'm in here, when the cell phones go off? Something in me, you could give me an answer in a second, when they go off, I know that I need to somehow just go on from there. Because it's the human consciousness is not, so I'm thinking, do I put a sign out there, turn off your cell phones, or some way as a reminder? It may not bother anybody else.
It shouldn't bother any of us. We should hear the voice of the Lord.
That's
saying, wake up, wake up, wake up.
It always happens, and it happens to everybody once in a while.
Don't be disturbed.
It's just a regular thing that happens.
No, it is in a way disturbing, it's a little shock.
But
you don't have to stick with that shock. You can let it pass.
There were three today.
There were three today.
Okay.
Last week, Don reminded us so nicely.
Yes.
But then in the middle of the class, his went off.
Today I forgot.
Okay.
So let's forgive each other our imperfections. Thank you, Lorraine. Yeah. Let's all try to be more conscious
about
it.
Also, the traffic outside is so loud.
There's something called white noise. Noisy, noisy, but yet we don't hear it because
we are absorbing.
We absorb something else. And there is that also, like the traffic outside. There's white noise.
Well, some people find the traffic very disturbing. But actually, we should be so concentrated on this marvelous text that all these things are really minor disturbances.
Well,
it's a good exercise
here.
Of concentration.
Yes.
Yes.
There's a Celtic
phrase
that says, "Let
him
be
loud."
He gives an image of the body being the soul, not the soul inside the body.
Yes.
The body. Seems to fit here.
Yes, of course, that is the truth, no? Mother tells us the psychic being is much bigger than the physical body. Yes. But somehow we have to go inside our physical body to make the context, because this is outer surface, and it has to go through successively our consciousness, our center of perception has to pass through subtler and subtler levels to find the point of contact, and then we can have this experience of becoming eternal and infinite and connected, deeply connected with everything.
He puts it as John Donahue says, "You are not a body with a spirit; you are a spirit with a body."
That's what he says.
You're a spirit.
The peaks of God, he talks about Kailash and things like that.
I think he's not speaking about earthly mountains.
Yeah.
He's speaking about the highest levels of consciousness and awareness. Bliss.
I can then hear change happens in bliss.
Yes, change happens, and more change is coming.
Yeah, and so I look at this from experience, and it goes like this.
Yes,
you know?
Fluctuating between one thing and another,
yeah.
Because both are true.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the thought that I kind of keep going on, whether like there's this reality or unknowable that's really indefinable, indecipherable, and then there's kind of different experiences of it. So there, one can experience it as this void, or one can experience it as the one reality that's full of love and presence or something. And now there's a question whether this latter experience kind of includes the other one or is superior to the other one. I mean, in some ways it's more enjoyable, right? Because it's full, you know, and it's...
I think the thing is that these two experiences don't contradict each other. As perhaps we will know when we have them.
When the mind and vital and everything has been completely quietened, then you can talk about that void or emptiness. When you as a person, personality don't exist anymore, where everything is very quiet. And only after that, he puts that chapter of oneness. Only when the frontal personality...
Who is this?
Supreme and
Supreme.
Consciousness.
Yes.
So he puts it in that order, that when the frontal personality is completely gone, completely silent,
then you can experience the oneness.
Yeah, because Sri Aurobindo also kind of experienced it in that order, sort of. There is nothing superior or inferior about it, but he experienced oneness after he had experienced a complete silencing of all the...
And yet, you know, that sense of oneness is one of these peak experiences which people just have unexpectedly. No? And there are some very, very beautiful descriptions of that, of people who have suddenly experienced the oneness, perhaps in nature or listening to, hearing beautiful music, or on some other occasion, some
without
apparent background. So then they come back to their other self. It's only that deathless memory, Sri Aurobindo says, no, that is there, and that's a help to come again to this experience. So it doesn't mean that one can't have the experience of the one self until you've gone through lives and lives of tapasya. No, it is something that's a true part of ourself, and if for whatever reason there's an opening, anyone can have it anywhere, anytime. But anyway, this is now he's somehow giving us this overview, no? And through Savitri, through her yoga, this is the way, step by step, it has come, and there's more to come. Yeah. Who's the next person to read, Raffaella?
She passed beyond time into eternity, slipped out of space and became the infinite. Her being rose into unreachable heights and found no end of its journey in the self. It plunged into the unfathomable deeps and found no end to the silent mystery that held all worlds within one lonely breast, yet covered all creation's multitude. She was all vastness and one measureless point. She was a height beyond heights, a depth beyond depth. She lived in the everlasting and was all that covers death and bears the wheeling arms. All contraries were true in one huge state, surpassing matter, measure, change, and circumstance. An individual, one with cosmic self, in the heart of the transcendence miracle and the secret of the world possibility, was the creator and the lord of all. Mind was a single, innumerable look upon himself and all that he became. Life was his drama, and vast the stage. The universe was his body, God its soul. All was one single immense reality, all its innumerable phenomena.
Thank you.
What happened with the change of gender here? We went from she to he. What happened there?
Let me see. Line 180.
Yeah.
An individual was the creator and the lord of all. So this is something that is perceived and experienced. I mean, it's not Savitri's self-experience. She sees this oneness, he, an individual, one with cosmic self. And there we have this trinity which we spoke of earlier. It's he, it's one, it's individual, any of us, all of us. We are one, in fact, with the universal self. And we are held in the heart of the transcendence miracle and the secret of world personality. So there's the transcendent beyond all limits. But there's also a person of the universe. So that individual was the creator and the lord of all this. So what we experience as mind, individual mind, actually that mind is working through every conscious being. Mind was a single, innumerable look on himself and on everything that he became. Life is the drama of that creator, and this vast is the stage for his drama. The universe is his body, the substance of his body, and God, his soul, all was one single immense reality. All all this, all these forms, its innumerable phenomena, numberless separate existences.
It's beautiful to sit here, to see all those people here, see through all their eyes, and there's also only one seeing.
But there isn't only one mouth. There's all these separate mouths, and it's also one.
One mouth and all those mouths, all those eyes, and there's one seeing, and there's
yes.
one hearing, but there are all those ears, and there's one heart, and all those hearts are beating.
Yes. And that one, I mean, Sri Aurobindo, I've spoken of it before, he's described this. He says, this is the goal, in fact, of evolution. This will be the goal that we're moving towards. He says, it's as if there's a honeycomb, and in that honeycomb, every drop of honey can feel itself, also all the other drops, and the one that the honeycomb as a whole. And the honeycomb can feel itself and all its drops, all at the same time. That's what would be the goal. That would be the marvelous experience of multiple bliss in oneness on the peaks of God that we're all evolving towards. It's in his little collection, Thoughts and Glimpses. Yes.
What is the sense of the sense behind of this evolution? Why do we need the evolution? Why is it? Would it not be possible that what the one had created?
Yeah, that's the question, precisely. Yeah. It's in order that this unnumbered multiplicity can happen. I know about this. I had this experience once. I was in a concert hall in London, packed with people. Klemperer was playing Mahler. And it was absolutely packed, the Royal Festival Hall, so more than 3,000 people, probably. And the performance came to an end, and everybody had enjoyed it so much, and there was incredible applause. And I was just feeling, the Lord has enjoyed it in every one of us differently. You know, each of those different experiences, he was present, and he was in everyone in the audience, and everyone in the orchestra, and the conductor, and all of us.
And in Mahler.
And, and enjoying all that. You know. As not separate. I mean, each of us individually is enjoying it separately, but he's enjoying it in all of us. And then I understood in London, in the tube, you know, why he brings all these souls close together, you know, all packed together. It's delightful for the souls to feel their nearness, the nearness of all the differences. So normally we don't experience it like that. But he says that this is the goal. This is why the Lord... last week we talked about the loneliness of the one, no? So he thought, wouldn't it be delightful if there were not just one, if there was an innumerable multiplicity and unity? And what would be the path to that, the fullness of that experience? It would be passing through this adventure of unconsciousness. The soul, the inner soul, growing, individual souls, experiencing all these steps of growing from being atoms or subatomic particles into becoming conscious beings, who can become aware that they're becoming more and more conscious, that they can participate in accelerating and enhancing and intensifying this experience. I think Jo says that's the reason for the manifestation, delight.
It's difficult to love in your alone, you know, you need something.
You need some, the love and the interference.
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So that's the experience that Savitri has now. She saw the possibility of it, now she has it. So who will read next? Audrey, you would read.
Her spirit saw the world as living God. It saw the One and knew that all was He. She knew Him as the absolute self-space, one with herself and ground of all things here, in which the world wanders seeking for the truth, guarded behind the space of ignorance. She followed Him through the march of endless time. All nature's happenings were events in her. The heartbeats of the cosmos were her own. All beings thought and felt and moved in her. She inhabited the vastness of the world. Its distances were her nature's boundaries, its closeness her own life's intimacies. Her mind became familiar with its mind. Its body was her body's larger frame, in which she lived and knew herself in it, one multitudinous in its multitude. She was a single being, yet all things. The world was her spirit's wide circumference. The thoughts of others were her intimates, their feelings close to her universal heart, their bodies, her many bodies, kin to her. She was no more herself, but all the world.
Mm, thank you. Shall we stop there for today? It's not nice to rush the last page.
No.
But you can read it if you like, Paula. Would you like to read it? The last page?
Right now?
Yeah, why not? Yes,
sir. Out of the infinitudes, all came to her. Into the infinitudes, sentient, she spread. Infinity was her own natural home. Nowhere she dwelt, her spirit was everywhere. The distant constellations wheeled around her. Earth saw her born, all worlds were her colonies. The greater worlds of life and mind were hers. All nature reproduced her in its lines. Its movements were large copies of her own. She was the single self of all these selves. She was in them and they were all in her. This first was an immense identity in which her own identity was lost. What seemed herself was an image of the whole. She was a subconscious life of tree and flower, the outbreak of the honeyed buds of spring. She burned in the passion and splendor of the rose. She was the red heart of the passion flower, the dream white of the lotus in its pool. Out of the subconscious life, she climbed to mind. She was thought and the passion of the world's heart. She was the Godhead hid in the heart of man. She was the climbing of his soul to God. The cosmos flowered in her. She was its bed. She was time and the dreams of God in time. She was space and the wideness of his days. From this she rose where time and space were not. The superconscient was her native air. Infinity was her movement's natural space. Eternity looked out from her on time.
Thank you. So there are three passages for this canto, but maybe we read the last one of canto six. We hear last one. Do
only
the last
one.
No, we do the last four passages.
One, two, four. Then four from six. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Unutterably effaced, no one annulled, a vanished vestige like a violet trace, a faint record merely of a self now past. She was a point in the unknowable. Yet all was not extinct in this deep loss. The being traveled not towards nothingness. There was some high surpassing secrecy, and when she sat alone with Satyavana, her moveless mind with his that searched and stole in the heart of the profound and intimate night. She turned to the face of a veiled, voiceless truth hid in the dumb recess of the heart, all waiting beyond the last peak climbed by soul. Now she sat by sleeping Satyavana, awake within, and the enormous night surrounded her with the unknowable vast. Out of the infinitudes, all came to her. Into the infinitudes, sentience she spread. Infinity was her own natural home. Nowhere she dwelt, her spirit was everywhere. The distant constellations wheeled around her. Earth saw her born. All worlds were her colony. The greater worlds of life and mind were hers. All nature reproduced her in its light. Its movements were large copies of her own. She was the single self of all these selves. She was in them, and they were all in her.
Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.